Welcome to Canadian Politique. I'm Cameron Bishop.
I'm Leanne Goodman.
I'm Mike McDougall.
And today on the show, well, the band is back together and we're going to be talking about Michelle Rempel's dive off the deep end and the ongoing debate over an 18-year-old groping allegation against the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper's secret visit to the White House, and the pending retirement of U.S. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. Plus, later in the show, I will be interviewing Edward Alden, an American journalist, author, and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States on the Canada-U.S. trade war. But more importantly, Mike has finally returned from being way overseas in the Philippines. Do you have a sponsor for us yet?
No, I was trying to get San Miguel to sponsor us, but they're not into it.
Okay.
They didn't want to do it. Yeah.
Wow. Well, did you manage to secure the, the president of the Philippines?
Holy shit. Okay, guys, this guy, this Duterte dude. So like you hear about him in Canada, like you hear that, you know, he kills drug dealers and stuff like that. But there's two things I learned about this guy. So when I'm over there, like you're jet lagged, right? So you're up super early and CNN has a Philippines, you know, station and there's English newspapers. So I'm just watching the news. We're news nerds, right? And so they report on this guy all the time. And the big scandal when I was there was this dude, like, he has this thing when he meets women, he just like kisses them on the lips. Like that's how he greets them. And, right. So there was this big scandal where like he was in Korea and he like kissed a woman on the lips he met on the street. And his response to it was like, listen, I have two wives and I have many girlfriends. You knew this when you elected so leave me alone. Right. And I'm just like, man, this guy's nuts. This guy, you know, another, the big story that was going on there too, the human rights watchdogs are there because he, in jail cells that are built for six people, he puts like 150 people in them. And the new thing is they're rounding up loiterers, like people that are just loitering in the streets, and they're putting them in jail. And so like this guy's nuts. But Filipinos that I've spoken to, they love the guy. Because wow. he is effective. Like he is cleaning up crime.
I mean, he does like tongue bathe women when he meets them.
Yeah, they kind of like there's parallels to like the Trump, in the sense that, you know, the attitude seems to be like, hey, he's not perfect, but that's who he is. Like, that's kind of how they're looking at it. Like, I, you know, watching this and reading in newspapers, I'm just like, man, this guy is like, he should be in The Hague right now on trial. But, you know, I was in the airport. I get there and the luggage is coming out. And there was a luggage coming out. It was all wrapped in plastic. And the woman beside me, she's like, oh, people still do that. And I go, why do they do that? And she said, well, back in the day, you had to wrap your luggage in plastic because like the baggage handlers would go into your luggage and take your stuff. But since Duterte got here, like that's all stopped. And I'm like, how did it stop? And she's like, don't worry about that. It stopped. And I'm just like, man.
And then she like wipes her mouth because she's like, and he made out with me after he protected my bag.
Maybe like the dude's like 70.
He didn't grab her by the pussy.
Well, he's something. He's something. I tell you that.
Is his face everywhere?
He's a weird guy.
Everywhere. Like not like dictator. Like the Philippines have, if you ever see pictures of it, there's ads. Like they don't have advertising regulations like we have here. So there's ads everywhere. But if you turn on the news or the newspaper, like media follow him around. And I think they do it because like they want, like he's a story everywhere he goes. He does something, right? But he does dominate the news.
Wow.
Very much so. Like he's on, if you're watching the local 6 o'clock news in the Philippines, like half of it is like Duterte said this, Duterte is doing this. And tomorrow this is what he's doing. Like they kind of report on his movement that way, so you can't escape that he's in charge there. But you know, most of the people I talk to, like when I tried to like tactfully bring up like, hey, your president's a little nuts, eh, they're like, well, he is, but you know, he's cleaning up the place and he's limiting corruption and he's making it better. So that's kind of the people I spoke to, like they're not as appalled on this guy as I am.
Is there a Mrs. Duterte?
There's two. He's got two wives. And according to his own admission last week, he has many, many girlfriends. So, you know, there's a lot of girls flock to the 73-year-old murderous president of the Philippines. A lot of them.
Wow.
He's a chick magnet.
Polygamy for the
win.
Honestly,
I've been trying to get a date with him for years, and he will not return my calls.
Yeah, I mean, Justin Trudeau needs to start kissing girls on the lips instead of, what's the allegation?
Grabbing their bums.
Yeah, grab their bum bums.
Is that, yeah, so let's talk about that now that we're segueing from
that's my segue.
A dirty Filipino president. over to a and by the way, I meant dirty Filipino in the sense of
naughty,
pervy.
Pervy. Let me rephrase pervy. That. Pervy Filipino president, who is a murderous man, to our prime minister, who, okay, so this week, Canadian media has been consumed with a story that 18 years ago, the prime minister apparently groped a reporter in BC. This was brought to light because of an unsigned editorial that appeared at the time in the Creston Valley Advance paper that said Trudeau had behaved inappropriately to the woman and that he apologized at the time for any inappropriate behavior towards the woman in question. The editorial did not provide any details, but said that Trudeau, quote, blatantly disrespected the reporter. When CNN reported on it this week, the network said they did not contact the reporter because she told CNN partner CBC News that she did not want her name to be used, did not want to be contacted about the story. The allegation resurfaced, though, this month after Warren Kinsella tweeted a picture of the editorial and used the Me Too hashtag. Valerie Bourne, who is the former publisher of the Creston Valley Advance, told CBC News that she spoke with a reporter in 2000 and said, you know, my recollections of the conversations were that she came to me because she was unsettled by it. She didn't like what had happened. She wasn't sure how she could proceed with it because, of course, we're talking about somebody who was known to the Canadian community. This former publisher goes on to say that she would not classify it or qualify it as sexual assault, but that Trudeau's alleged actions were definitely not welcome and definitely inappropriate. Of course, this has set off like the nuclear bomb of hand-wringing by MPs like Michelle Rempel, conservative MPs like Michelle Rempel and Lisa Raitt, Candace Bergen. And yesterday, Lorraine Harper jumped in on it, too. You know, Lorraine Harper, who was in the face of protesters demanding action on missing and murdered Indigenous women back when her husband ran the place, said that she was here that evening at a fundraiser. We're here for homeless cats. So thank you, Lorraine Harper, for homeless cats. She's suddenly Cheddar Harper. She's suddenly very concerned, though, about groping allegations from 18 years ago. So I'm going to kick this over to Leanne first. So what do you think?
I don't like the whole argument that, okay, but what about this? Like, okay, but he did this, but what about you? You know what I mean? Like, if he did it, it's shitty.
Yeah.
And it's a story. It's certainly a story. But on the other hand, if he apologized at the time and the person at the center of it doesn't want it going any further, I don't know what more you can do. Like, I mean, he did have a reputation back then. This is before he was married, I believe, right?
Yeah.
It was 2000.
Yeah. Right after his dad died.
He had a reputation back then as being a bit of a playboy. Everybody knew about it. I just don't know what you do with it now. It's 18 years ago. He apologized at the time. The woman doesn't want it to go any further. So I'm not sure what you do with it anymore. But I also, I certainly agree that it's a story, and I understand why the conservatives are all over it. And they have every right to be, because he does look hypocritical as being that he's, you know, he's gone on about Me Too and being a feminist, but also that was a long time ago and people evolved. And I don't necessarily believe that the conservatives are wrong for making a big deal about it, but I'm not sure where else it goes now. Like, it's kind of done. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's all I have to say. I find Warren Kinsella's involvement a little sneaky too, to be honest, and I won't get into it because that guy's litigious, but he has access to grind with the Trudeau Liberals. That's all I can tell you without getting myself into trouble. So as soon as I saw that Warren Kinsella was involved in the whole thing, it made me a bit suspicious.
Well,
anyway,
I would just say before Mike jumps in that there is a story talking about Michelle Rempel again. It's on HuffPo, and it says the headline is Tory MP compares Trudeau's groping claim response to Harvey Weinstein. Michelle Rempel told the status of women minister to, quote, grow a pair, end quote, on feminist issues. Then she goes on to say in this interview with HuffPo, while I'm sure Harvey Weinstein said that he couldn't recall things either, talking about Trudeau's denial that anything happened 18 years ago. Anybody want to take a kick at that? Is Trudeau the new Canadian Harvey Weinstein, Mike?
No, I mean, he's not, but I do have a problem with Trudeau's kind of response to it. And part of that, a lot of that does stem from, you know, what Trudeau said. You know, Trudeau has been quoted saying, you know, sexual harassment is a systemic issue. And he said, it's our responsibility to listen to them and to believe them. And so for him to kind of say, I don't remember, I didn't like that because I thought it was a bit of a cop out. Like, I would have preferred his response to say, you know what, you know, I don't remember, but, you know, we should definitely, you know, listen to this person. I mean, this isn't, it is a story. I agree with Leanne. It is a story. It was 18 years ago and we don't really know what happened, but he's clearly not Harvey Weinstein. And it's the same too, the way, and, you know, liberals and we all consider ourselves progressives, but it's the same way that, you know, Doug Ford's not Donald Trump. Right. Like, I mean, people tend to have this tendency to, you know, call people, you know, I call it the Hitler effect. Like, everybody's Hitler when we don't agree with them. Trudeau's not Harvey Weinstein, but that doesn't mean that he probably shouldn't address this a little better and maybe respond a little more sensitive to the allegations against him.
Yeah. Like, all he needs to say, you're right. I mean, all he needs to say is, you know, I don't recall the incident that happened 18 years ago in the same way. I believed it was a positive incident. However, but then I go back to what Leanne said. How is it a story if the person doesn't want anything to do with this whatsoever? I mean, she's not come forward herself. This was just somebody retweeting an article that appeared 18 years ago or an editorial. So it's hard to, like, she's obviously being approached and she's continuing to say, no, I'm not going to get into this. So at what point does it become something we stop talking about? And I don't want to undercut, because I do believe the victims. But I do also, you know, if she's not willing to come forward at this point, I'm not too sure, like Leanne said, what more can be done. And I don't think it's particularly helpful when we have conservative MPs trashing the status of women minister and trying to kind of get into some protracted debate on who's a better feminist because of how they're responding to something that happened 18 years ago or might have happened 18 years ago. And I don't think it's appropriate either for Michelle Rempel, who is coming off, I think lately, between her bitching and moaning about the ongoing bad treatment of conservatives in the media, because the media have started flat out calling the conservatives liars, because that's what they are on almost every issue. They're ginning up outrage on different things. Michelle Rempel is coming off as one of the mean girls. She might not be Regina George, but she's definitely a Gretchen Wieners.
You love her, eh?
Oh, you know, I thought that Candace Bergen was my least favorite person.
She's my least favorite.
Oh, I mean, she's vile. But certainly Michelle Rempel is quickly rounding the bend towards the finish line, because I can't. She just, like, it's just so, I get it. It's not a good situation the prime minister finds himself in. But, you know, telling the status of women minister to grow a pair, comparing him to Harvey Weinstein, fuck off. Come on. You know, like, fuck off. And by the way, where was all of this outrageous outrage when Rick Dykstra has been accused of sexual assault back in 2014 and Stephen Harper, who was then prime minister and leader of the Conservative Party, Rick Dykstra, a former Conservative MP, former president of the PC Party of Ontario now, was allowed to run, even though he is under investigation for sexual assault against a staffer of a Conservative MP? Where was Michelle Rempel and Lisa Raitt and Candace Bergen and Laureen Homeless Cats Harper? Where were they? Where were they? And well, now suddenly they're outraged. Fuck off.
Well, in fairness, apparently behind the scenes, they were all fucking appalled by Rick Dykstra. I remember the story about Jenny Byrne.
Oh, yeah.
Right. The women in the caucus were pretty horrified by Rick Dykstra, but it was one of those situations where you don't go out publicly against Harper because, well, you know how that went. Oh. So I will give them, I kind of know some of the women in that little group back when I was covering Parliament Hill. Like, it was those guys, Lisa Raitt.
Bonnie Raitt.
We'd love to hear you sing though, Lisa.
Lisa Raitt and Stella Ambler, who was wonderful. They were sort of this little, like, secretly feminist cabal in the caucus who really didn't like Harper very much. So I agree with you that Rempel seems to have gone completely off the rails. But it gave me some hope for the future of the party. Like, I thought, okay, great. If somebody like Lisa Raitt gets in, this party could actually be a viable option for a lot of people who just won't go there anymore.
Right.
And, you know, so what do? They go for Andrew Scheer. So, once again, the Conservative Party making, well, then again, what am I, who am I to say? Look at Doug Ford. He's now premier of the province. But yeah. In any event, I do know that behind the scenes, they were quite appalled by Dykstra and other things that were going on that area. So, but you're right. Everybody just needs to simmer down, right?
If Rick Dykstra forced a woman, which this is the allegation, to suck him off in his hotel room after the woman was drunk and continued to harass her, I don't care if these women, Lisa, Michelle, Candace, Laureen, were secretly pissed off and didn't like Harper and talked about it and they were appalled. Suddenly they grow a pair, to use Michelle's phrasing, suddenly they grow a pair after Harper's long gone, and the way they demonstrate they've grown a pair is to trash the prime minister on an 18-year-old allegation when they've got a 4-year-old investigation ongoing that one of their caucus colleagues raped a staffer. Give me a fucking break. Come on.
Well, just have a line.
I will take no lessons from conservatives when it comes to how they handle the affairs of powerful men dealing with women. Give me a break. You're a feminist by convenience, ladies. I'm sorry. And by the way, Michelle and Lisa and Rachel Harder and Candace Bergen, you're feminist by convenience because you know what? Feminism also is about supporting a woman's right to choose. And that party is not willing to publicly back a woman's right to choose. They prefer to, like,
that's true,
you know, give me a break.
You're
they
right
have
about that.
Nothing to, they are known defenders of women. I'm sorry. They're defenders of themselves. And they think that they've got a good thing that they can run up the poll against the prime minister. And that's all this is. I don't agree if he did anything wrong. I think that that's terrible and he should apologize. But, you know, I will take no moralizing from the Conservative Party of Canada when they've got a alleged sexual assaulter who sat in caucus and they were too goddamn scared of Stephen Harper to say anything.
Agreed.
Thank you. Thank you.
Alrighty.
I'm coming in hot.
Any politician, politics sucks, right? Like, have a line that you're not willing to cross, right? So, and that goes to the Liberals, that goes to the NDP, it goes to the Republicans, it goes to the Democrats. There needs to be a line that, as a person, you can say, you know what, at this point, the politics is trivial. This is the line that you can't cross, and I'm going to stand up for it. And these guys don't have that backbone. And, you know, so
they only have a backbone when Stephen Harper isn't there with a belt to beat them into submission. Give me a break. It's pathetic. And by the way, Michelle, Lisa, and Candace Bergen were all in cabinet. So that tells you all you need to know. They wouldn't resign on principle in terms of how this was handled. They wouldn't speak out because they were more concerned about their job as opposed to this staffer that they apparently, according to you, Leanne, they were quietly appalled and talking amongst themselves, but they couldn't do anything. Well, thanks very much. You know what? My grandma was part of a bridge club too, and they talked a lot and discussed things, and God love them. They had a lot of fun. But my grandma wasn't in cabinet, and neither were her friends. And if you really have principles, you resign if you're that fucking appalled. Give me a break. Okay, good.
All right.
Let's talk, though, about Stephen Harper, because he was shown the door by Canadian voters in 2015 after 10, almost 10, long, hellish, cold years of misery. But this week, on Monday, our former Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, stopped by the White House for reasons nobody is really certain of. He didn't bother to tell the sitting government of his intention to meet with Trump's economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, or Trump's national security advisor, John Bolton. No, it was a quick call from the White House to the Canadian Embassy in Washington asking for more information on, quote, the prime minister's visit, end quote, that alerted the Trudeau prime minister's office. Harper, of course, being a slave to status and titles, had evidently referred to himself as prime minister in trying to set up these meetings in D.C., so what was the agenda? And has he gone in there to wipe his feet on the flag of Canada, like a very nice political cartoon showed him walking into the Oval Office and the Canadian flag laid down on the carpet with all these boot marks all over it? What the hell gives?
Unbelievable.
Right?
I don't know. And, you know, all I want to know and all I would like to ask him is, hey, did you mention your old pal Putin, the guy that you confronted at an APEC meeting in Australia and said, get your ass out of Ukraine?
Yeah.
You okay with him meeting with his puppet?
Yeah.
The guy that he helped put in power? Like, I don't understand how he has any moral how he cannot have a moral problem with having anything to do with Trump. Never mind arranging a secret meeting. Like, what's going on? Are they plotting to get Justin? I don't understand what's going on and what he's up to.
See, now I would say that they are, because remember Harper and his wildly successful consulting firm, Stephen Harper and Associates, because that's what happens to apparently former prime ministers who don't have much career potential. Before they get into office.
He's at Denton's, isn't he? No, maybe, but he runs
his own associate firm, Stephen Harper and Associates consultant. Remember, he sent around like a brief to his client base. This is a few months ago, trashing the Trudeau Liberals on their approach to NAFTA, essentially undercutting the prime minister and his government, despite the fact that some of his former ministers, including James Moore, who was industry minister under Stephen Harper, and Rona Ambrose, who served in a number of different capacities, finishing off as health minister under Harper and then becoming interim opposition leader after he'd resigned. They sit on the prime minister's NAFTA advisory council. But Stephen Harper trashes the prime minister in the NAFTA negotiations in a confidential memo to his client base, and now is seen going into the White House. I wasn't sure if there were any knee pads that Stephen Harper was bringing in, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, he wasn't meeting with Trump, though, right? He was meeting with that Larry Kudlow, that former CNN guy. What's it about? He's the senior economic advisor to Trump. What's Harper got to say?
Well,
about economic issues to the White House.
I'm assuming they were talking about NAFTA.
Well, yes, obviously, but this is the guy who couldn't get Keystone going. Like, what's his bona fides? Why is he?
Yeah,
he didn't do much to improve Canada-U.S. relations. It's not like Trudeau is failing where Harper succeeded. Like Obama and Harper did not have a great relationship. He could never. He tried threatening. Remember to get the Keystone approved, that went over well.
Yeah,
like he didn't have any gravitas in the U.S. Capitol in terms of Canada-U.S. relations. He was just viewed as a dud, a dolt, and a dud. And so I'm not really sure why the Trump. Well, then again, it's the Trump White House.
And whose side is he on? Whose side is he on? Like if he is talking about NAFTA. After trashing in a memo to his clientele the Trudeau government's approach, if he won't coordinate on messaging, if he won't even advise the government of the day, regardless of the fact that it was the man who defeated him, if he won't even coordinate with Foreign Affairs or Global Affairs Canada, rather, or the Prime Minister's office, whose side is he on in the NAFTA negotiations?
Well, you know, it'd be great if he actually did go there to defend NAFTA, as Chrystia Freeland seemed to suggest, right? Good. Okay, fine. But why the secrecy? Why not tell the government that you're doing it?
Can I get conspiratorial here for a second?
Yes.
We've discussed on this pod that it, you know, it wouldn't be completely out of reason for Stephen Harper to go for the CPC leadership.
That's what I think.
Right? So do you think maybe he's putting his ducks in order so that when he does do that, he can come out with U.S. support that he's going to fix the mess, the NAFTA mess, and obviously steer the message into, you know, the Trudeau government is losing NAFTA. They're in a trade war with the United States right now. Elect me. I'm going to fix both of them. It's possible.
Well, in order to make that happen, though, Scheer has to lose, right?
It would be unprecedented. Like, I guess maybe when Trudeau came back after resigning and then Trump and then Clark got voted out on a vote of non-confidence. Like, it would be pretty wild if it happened.
We've seen unprecedented global politics these last few years, right? Brexit, Trump, like all this stuff happening. This is the time to do something unprecedented.
You are right.
You know, it's funny because...
Remember, did he not know that even his own party hated him at the end?
Like, yeah, but remember what he said a few weeks ago? He said that he could definitely be a conservative leader if he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
he did say that.
So, we're going to have to deal with this guy again in one of the official residences. Stornoway has no cat pee in it. Stay away, Stephen Harper.
Friends of mine the other day, we were talking about, we're obsessed with Handmaid's Tale, and I don't know if you guys are watching it. I think you are, Mike, but it's like the way it parallels what's going on without them couldn't have known how bang on they would be from week to week. But in any event, it's frightening. We were talking about it. My friends were saying, you know, honestly, in North America, this stuff all started getting resurrected again under Harper. Harper was the guy who was anti-science. leftists, right?
Yep.
Even more so than Bush. Harper was the guy who hated the media, created the media list where you couldn't ask him any mm-hmm. questions unless they'd been pre-approved. Like, Harper started a lot of this shit going in North America. He didn't go after the social conservative stuff because he knew that wouldn't fly in Canada. But who knows where it could go if there's a feeling that there's an acceptance of that as well, as there is in the U.S. on abortion, right?
Right.
And the ego part of changing the name of the government to your own name.
Yeah, like Harper got the ball rolling on a lot of this stuff, even far more than George W. Bush did, who was sort of, you know,
a great president.
A moderate. A moderate by comparison, right? Anyway, like Bush did great stuff with AIDS in Africa. And,
yes.
He wasn't anti-climate change and... Anyway, so it's an interesting point that actually it was Harper that started the ball rolling on some of this really scary anti-media, enemy of the state, don't trust science bullshit that has now like taken hold in the United States. So great. Let's hope. I'm going to say that's not happening.
Yeah.
It can't happen that he comes back.
Well, are you prepared to change your name to Of Steven?
I'm too old to bear children. I couldn't be a handmaid anymore. I'd be a Martha. I'd be in the kitchen fucking scrubbing the potatoes.
And Cameron can be Aunt Lydia.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think Michelle Rempel will be Aunt Lydia.
Yeah, Michelle Rempel will be Aunt Lydia. Candace
you Bergen, will obey. And then she picks somebody's eye out with a spoon.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk something all happier. Right. The impending destruction of abortion rights in the United States. Well,
go on.
Anthony Kennedy, who is the conservative Supreme Court justice, but sometimes often a swing vote in a 9-person court and often is the swing vote in 5-4 majorities, was retiring. He was appointed by President Reagan in 1987. And as I say, he's often been the deciding vote on major issues from protecting a woman's right to choose to allowing gay marriage in the United States. But he decided it was time to hang up the robes this week, giving Trump his second Supreme Court appointment and the chance to shape the court for a generation or more. Trump is said to be looking at somebody that is in their 40s so that they can serve for 40 or 50 years. But as a conspiracy theorist, which I'm not normally, but why not? We're all in the age of Steve, of Dawn, of handmaidens and shit. Rumors have also circulated, though, that Kennedy's retirement from the court is part of an elaborate relationship with Trump involving Kennedy's son, Justin. During Justin Kennedy's tenure at Deutsche Bank, that institution became Trump's most important lender, dispensing well over $1 billion in loans to him for the renovation and construction of skyscrapers in New York and Chicago at a time when other mainstream banks were wary of doing business with him because of his bad business history. So did Anthony Kennedy do a solid for Donald Trump and get out of the way? Is this part of some conspiracy theory? And what does it mean for abortion rights, gay marriage, all sorts of different things, voting rights, even let's face it, you know, racial issues in the United States, such as segregation. What does this all mean?
It's terrifying. I don't know enough to understand whether this conspiracy theory, if there's anything to it. But why is he retiring? Like, none of them retire. They basically do it till they die.
Right.
So why? He's not that old, right? He's what, early 70s?
He's 81.
Oh, he's 81. Oh, yeah. He looks good. Looking at him now, he looks pretty, looking pretty good for an 81-year-old. Anyway, but I mean, Ruth Ginsburg has been near death for 5 years, and she's hanging in.
Keep planking, Ruth Ginsburg. Keep planking.
I'm just confused and I'm scared. However, I'm reading more these days about the Roe versus Wade dangers. And that will be really hard to do because, you know, you have to, these are intelligent people. Even if they're partisan,
yes.
They are generally, except for Clarence Thomas, who can be really obtuse apparently, and is a complete useless tool on that panel. He never speaks. He doesn't have anything to say and his decisions kind of suck.
He's too busy putting pubic hair on Coke, remember?
Like, yeah. John Roberts is supposed to be a conservative, but he's voted in favor of Obamacare because if they look at things by the letter of the law, And they do value their careers and their reputations. Like, I want to believe that it won't be as bad as we fear it could be.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold my breath. What about you, Mike?
I just can't believe they would turn over Roe versus Wade. Like, I just, honest to God, that country is just, as Ireland frees up abortion, as Ireland makes abortion legal, the United States takes a step back 50 years. I
think that we're selling the United States a bit short on this one. I agree with Leanne. I think that, you know, Cameron, you mentioned even with segregate, they're not going to go back. I have too much, and I could be wrong, obviously, but I don't think I am. I have too much respect for Americans to think that they would go back in time with certain judicial decisions that way. I don't know. I know that media and, like, you know, there's certain politicians that have really strong opinions, but I really don't think that the country of America feels that strongly about certain things that they'd want to overturn 60-year-old decisions. And I think that I agree. The Supreme Court, they are intelligent, and, you know, the Roe versus Wade, I've been trying to, this all came out when I was in the Philippines, so I wasn't able to follow it, but I've tried to follow it a little bit since I got home. And I feel like the Roe versus Wade concern is media created. Trump has never said he wants to overturn Roe versus Wade. And when you look at who, you know, like the rumors that are coming out, like, I almost feel like this is a bit fear mongering, and I think we need to just wait to see what happens. I would be very surprised if that came up. I honestly would be. I think that it's just it's a nice side thing to get the Democrats all riled up and organized while something else happens. Like, it's one of those classic, hey, look at this shiny object, because I think this is a shiny object. That's all I think it is.
Well, just remember, though, that Donald Trump, during the election campaign, he was asked by, I believe it was Chris Matthews, about whether or not women should be punished for having abortions, and Donald Trump said that yes, he believes that some form of punishment was necessary. That was what he said. It came out of his mouth. That was true. And then you've got Mike Pence, who, when he was in the House of Representatives, stood up and said that he looks forward to the day that Roe versus Wade is on the ash bin of history. And he promised, I'm quoting from an article on the Medium, Mike Pence has promised that legal abortion will end, quote, in our time. And Trump has also...
Fuck you, Mike Pence. Fuck you, who can't even be in a fucking room with a woman other than your wife.
Yeah.
Because they're such temptresses. And also, let's keep them pregnant. Like, fuck you. And also, you assholes, I'm sorry, this is a real thing for me. If you want to reduce abortion, then start making birth control more accessible to women. It's just a real no-brainer, you stupid motherfucking old white men. At the same time you're trying to just deny access to abortion, you're making it more difficult for women to go on birth control. You're suggesting that women are sluts if they want the birth control pill paid for. Remember Rush Limbaugh saying that a few years ago?
Yes.
So this is when I do get into this thing in my head is, oh my God, it is handmade. They not only want to force us to have children, they don't want us to be on birth control. Like, that's all they want to do with us. But honestly, all these hypocrites care about are the babies in the womb. Once the baby's out of the womb, they don't give a shit. Look at these poor kids in cages. Where are the pro-lifers for the kids in the cages? The two-year-olds having to go to court by themselves and draw pictures to explain what the drug dealers are waiting outside their school when they're in Mexico.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you care about the children who are out of the womb? But I'm sorry, I just went off on a little feminist
rant. Mike Pence does have a rabbit. That might make him
up. Fuck you, Mike Pence. Don't go out for dinner with women because they might tempt you. As if any of them would want to have sex with you anyway.
Well,
call
he calls
your wife mother.
I know. I was just going to say, he calls his wife mother.
That's a real... I don't know about you guys, but I get really turned on if the guy that I'm boning is calling me mommy. Anyway.
That's awesome.
Wow.
You know how the Roe versus Wade might be saved? Because public opinion poll after public opinion poll shows that the population, the Americans, like it, regardless of what Pence and his ilk want to the rest of us to believe. And even though the Supreme Court in theory is immune from that sort of thing, they're not. There's some research to suggest that Supreme Court justices are, in fact, aware of public opinion and respond to public opinion and will base decisions on public opinion.
Yeah.
So I want to believe it's not going to happen. It would just be so terrifying if it does. But then I think you'll get into a, I just think you'll get into a state situation where the states will decide how it goes.
I have too much faith in America that they will be fine. They're going to get through this era, and it will be an era, right? We're going to look back on history as this era of like, what the fuck was going on? But, you know, it's been worse there. Like, as far as just, you know, public dissent has been worse there than it is now. And this will get better. And I think that I really don't think it's going to happen. I don't.
The thing is,
you know, you and me are like, I have faith in Americans. It's Americans that are leading the resistance. It's the Americans that are fighting this guy more than any of us are. And I have faith too. I just think it's a terrible, awful blip. It's a backlash to Obama. And it's the last gasp of these assholes is what I'm really, really hoping.
And it'll start to get better.
Because we've seen how bad it can get and how close it is getting to being a complete shit show. And I want to believe that people are going to be scared and they're going to swing back the other way. Oh, God, I'm knocking on wood right now. I'm knocking on lots of wood. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Knocking on wood because it's terrifying. I'm actually feeling dread and quite terrified at the moment about what's going on down there.
But you should. We all should, because honestly,
but what do we do? Like, I feel like we need to be doing something, and I don't know what you do other than sit and watch in helpless horror and just
well, we can get down. We're lucky enough.
All your American friends.
We're lucky enough that we live close enough to the United States that we can go down and help campaign for Democrats in the
unless you get stopped at the border, which is happening to a lot of people now.
That's
like,
true.
Just people for no reason at all. Just like no. Sorry, you can't come in.
We should build a wall.
We should build a wall. Scott Walker wanted. Scott Walker from Wisconsin thought building a wall between us and the United States would be productive.
Do it.
Eat me, Scott Walker. But for those Americans who are, like Leanne, wondering what they can do, I'll give you two ideas. One is register to vote. www.vote.org. Get in there, go register to vote, find out your district, find out how you can get involved. It takes 2 minutes. And also visit swingleft.org. That is a website that is looking at ways to flip the House of Representatives in 2018, because it's going to be decided by a small number of swing districts, places where the last election was decided by a very, very thin margin. So go to swingleft.org, find out how you can help, find out how you can get involved, and hopefully put a check on this president. The House would be wonderful. The Senate and the House would be absolutely fucking brilliant. So get involved, Americans.
Okay, but my only fear about that, I think we've discussed this before, is if they win in 2018, if they win both chambers of Congress,
yeah,
will there be a backlash in 2020 that gets him back in?
I think he's going to win either way. I think he's going to win either way.
I don't think he is.
Oh, well.
If you look at where his numbers are right now, that's a real uphill battle.
Yeah.
But I just fear that if they crush him in 2018, does that give him a little bit of a push in 2020?
Could.
If they crush him in 2018, though, the Republicans may move to impeach him. And apparently the thing that is really causing Republicans now to think about impeaching him, not all the other Russia bullshit, well, not bullshit, that doesn't seem to bother them. It's the tariffs. It's the trade war. That's what's getting them to really turn on them.
But the Republicans are willing to look the other way right now. And you know why? Taxes and judges. Mitch McConnell is farting judges up, right-wing, hardcore, and young justices onto the bench across, you know, the federal court system that Trump is putting through. He's ramming these judges through.
Yeah.
They're willing to tolerate this kind of BS from Trump because of taxes and judges. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all. Anyway, stories of the week. Leanne?
Oh, my God. I saw this guy I follow on Twitter who had a visit from the Secret Service because he'd been tweeting weird shit. He wasn't tweeting weird shit about Trump. He was tweeting out hostile things about Trump. No threats, but, you know, calling him evil.
Yes.
And the Secret Service show up on his door.
Yeah.
So this is what's happening now.
Well, hey, that's their job, though.
You better ease up. There wasn't a threat. There were no threats.
Well,
just that he was evil.
Did he not also say that they were really professional to him and they left?
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he like did. And apparently he got the impression that they thought it was stupid that he was there, that they were there. That it was just, you know, the routine. Hey, we better calm down. But imagine that this is happening now. You tweeting out, hey, fuckface, orange dickhead, let the children out of their cages.
Yeah.
And suddenly there's a knock on the door and the Secret Service is there. Like, that's terrifying.
It is.
It is. But if I want to jump in on this a little bit, because I've heard of this happening before under Obama as well, when people were, now the stuff people were saying about Obama was way worse. But do you think this also could be a product of the fact that the mediums that we now have access to display our opinions are more advanced than they were 10 years ago? So that's, you know, like the Secret Service, it's not new news that the Secret Service would pay a visit to someone that they might just to do a temperature check to see someone right. that's criticized like that. That's happened before. I don't think this would be Trump directing this. This is a Secret Service thing.
I hope so.
Well, if the because Secret Service Obama, is hearing like this, Obama, I guess we're all getting a visit.
400% more death threats than any other president, right? With Obama, there was an actual serious and real concern that somebody was going to assassinate him. I don't think Trump's numbers are where Obama's were in terms of death threats.
No, because all the crazies already support him.
Yeah. The people with the guns.
And I was going to say the leftists don't have guns.
That's right. We have love.
So, I don't know. That one gave me a made me feel frightened.
All right, Mike.
You know what? I don't really have one. I just got back into the country 2 days ago. John Tavares signed with the Leafs. That's cool. Don't hate me for that.
Everybody loves that.
Yeah, my news consumption the last month has been not relevant to this podcast. I promise I'll do better next week. I really don't have.
Well, maybe your story is your crazy. We can edit it and put your story as the crazy Filipino president.
Well, did we talk about, I listened to half of last week's episode, not the whole one. Did anyone talk about Aunt Lydia getting kicked out of the restaurant?
Oh, no, we didn't talk about Sarah Huckabee being booted from the restaurant.
Yeah,
so that was interesting. I mean, you know, they really grasped onto that one and made it, like, now she has Secret Service protection. Did you hear about that?
Yes.
Yeah, I would assume she already did, but I guess not.
She's built like a linebacker. You know, I would think she can protect herself.
Look, I know you don't like the public stocks, Mike, but I'm sorry. In a democracy, if you're doing things like locking up children and you go out to a restaurant and the people in that restaurant find you abhorrent and it's a capitalist system, they can kick you the fuck out. I
agree
no problem
with you.
With that.
No. No, so my point on public stocks is that I think that we shouldn't be using social media for private citizens type thing. But if you're a public figure, man, all the power to you. There was a woman a few days ago that confronted Scott Pruitt in a restaurant.
Yes.
Like, go for it, right? But listen, Aunt Lydia, if they don't want you to eat in the restaurant, you know, that's just too bad. Just don't eat there and don't be sanctimonious about it.
Can somebody explain to me why those two idiots, Stephen Miller and then that Christian, whose last name I'm forgetting.
Oh, Nielsen, the director of Homeland Security.
Hey, real smart of you to choose Mexican restaurants.
I know.
Were there no Norwegian restaurants open? You know, the non-shithole countries? Maybe you could have found a Norwegian restaurant instead of going to a Mexican restaurant when you're terrorizing people seeking asylum.
Well, and let's face it.
And the children.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders can afford to skip a meal or two, okay? Well, I'm just going to say it. You know what?
The New Yorker did a fantastic profile on Stephen Miller I read while I was away. We should link it on our Facebook page because it's like the reporter's just incredulous on like he's like, I don't understand if this guy's actually like screwing with me right now or is he actually this ridiculous, right? It's pretty good. Is pretty good.
And you know what? That guy was raised by liberal Democrats.
I know. Yeah. It's such a sad reality.
It's very, like, what? Talk about Alex P. Like, the monster version of Alex P. Keaton.
Yeah, I know. He's, like, bereft of a heart. Completely.
Yeah.
And he's a white supremacist. I don't remember any Family Ties episode where Skippy and Alex went and lit a cross on fire on somebody's lawn.
No. But he's very attractive.
Who?
Just kidding.
Oh,
Stephen Miller.
No,
he looks like, he looks like Monty Burns, young version.
We need to edit Leanne saying, just kidding, and just go with that.
I think so.
No, you don't. No.
My story of the week, by the way, is very quick, and it is that the NDP up here in Canada are so damn broke federally. Now, I just want to say I voted NDP provincially because I love Andrea Horvath and I loved her platform. Jagmeet Singh, however, bit of a dud, but they're so broke that Jagmeet Singh is no longer or will not be taking a salary until the financial position of the party improves, which,
Jesus.
Yeah. So I don't know what kind of a testimonial that is for their handling of the Canadian economy and why they should be entrusted with it, but they're so broke that he cannot even afford to take a salary. So well done, NDP. Really well done.
He's working for free. How does he support himself?
I don't know. Is he working? He's only in Ottawa once a week, maybe. He won't run for a by-election seat. He just shit the bed in Quebec. He fell from second place to fourth in the by-election that was held there. Nobody knows who he is. He's got like scandal after scandal piling on his party, and he's just kind of a lousy leader.
Yeah, he's just
a
weak
leader. That's a shame. I was hoping for good things from that guy. I wanted him to do well.
Well, apparently,
not everybody can pull off a brightly colored turban and an Armani suit.
Well, listen, they expected good things too from him, the NDP, but they just don't want to pay him. they can't afford to pay him.
The problem with that Armani suit is that it's empty.
Ooh,
I guess that's a good way to end it.
It sure is. Oh, and by the way, Leanne, very sorry to hear about Dolly. I'm glad you guys had a little vacation together before she passed away.
I know. I'm so glad I did that now. At the time, it was like, what kind of a loser am I alone on a vacation with my dog? But it was perfect. She liked the river and she could wade every day. It was very sudden, but she was old. But anyway, I'm a bit of a mess. I can't talk about it now.
All right. Well, we dedicate this to Dolly. Thanks, Leanne. Yes, thanks, Mike.
Dolly.
Welcome back, buddy.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. From the G7 summit in Charlevoix, Quebec, that ended very badly when President Trump got back on Air Force One and trashed Prime Minister Trudeau, to the ongoing pinpricks he's making in President Trump, of course, in alliances, whether they be NATO or at the WTO or Canada-US trade or EU trade or China-US trade. There is a lot going on in the world right now, and Donald Trump is the center of the storm, and he's directing it. I sat down with Edward Alden, who is an American journalist, author, and a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations in the United States. Now, Mr. Alden specializes in U.S. economic competitiveness, U.S. trade policy, and visa and immigration policy. He is also the author of a number of books, one of which is The Closing of the American Border, Terrorism, Immigration, and Security Since 9/11. This was a finalist for the Lucas Book Prize, and Failure to Adjust, How Americans Got Left Behind in the Global Economy. He is also, just as an aside, a Canadian in the sense that while he was born in New York State, he was actually raised in Vancouver, British Columbia. Beautiful part of the world to be raised, of course. He actually graduated from the University of British Columbia and got his MA in International Relations and Foreign Affairs from the University of California at Berkeley. Really good interview. He is, a fountain of knowledge. And, you know, sometimes with all these things that are going on in the world, with so many things whizzing by us all the time, with Twitter tirades by the U.S. president, it's tough to keep up. But he's done me a real service in helping me understand things a little bit better. He's given me a little bit better insight. So here's the interview with Ted Alden. Hope you enjoy it. Thanks for joining the pod, Ted. I'm really, really pleased to have you on.
It's great to be with you, Cameron. Thank you.
So lots to discuss, but most important, right off the mark, I want to just ask you, how bad has Donald Trump affected the Canada-US relationship, and how long would it take to reset it?
Well, I mean, I think the Canada-U.S. relationship right now is at an astonishingly low point. People are looking for various historical parallels, you know, maybe Trudeau-Nixon, maybe Lester Pearson when he was fighting with Lyndon Johnson over the Vietnam War. So there's no question relations are at a very low point. I think they could be repaired quickly if there were some changes in policy, but for the moment, that doesn't seem terribly likely. So I think we're in for a rough stretch for a while now.
So we have announced, as you are well aware, we have announced $16 billion worth of tariffs, dollar for dollar, on the tariffs that the president's U.S. administration has put on Canadian steel and Canadian lumber. But one of the claims that one of the claims that President Trump made in doing this is that Canada has screwed over the United States and that we have a huge trade deficit with America. Number one, we don't, but I'd love you to expand on that a little bit and where he's getting this idea, false as it is, how he's trying to twist the numbers in terms of whether or not there is a trade deficit. And on a kind of parallel to that, are trade deficits, even though we don't have one, are they inherently harmful in the short or medium term?
Okay, so sort of two big questions there. I mean, the first one, Donald Trump has been obsessed with the trade deficit as a metric for the U.S. losing in global trade for a long time. Going back to the mid-1980s when he first began to flirt with the idea of running for president and was so upset by the large trade deficit that the U.S. was running with Japan at the time. So this is an old issue for the president. I don't have a clear understanding of why he lumps Canada into this, because, you know, by all measures, U.S.-Canada trade is roughly balanced, depending on whose figures you believe. Canada either runs a slight surplus or a slight trade deficit with the United States. But, you know, Trump is often kind of fast and loose with the facts, and so he's lumped Canada in with Mexico and Germany and Japan and China and every other country that he seems to have a problem with. The consensus among economists is that a trade deficit is not inherently a bad thing if it results from strong economic growth and, is an indicator of kind of underlying economic strength. You know, the United States buying a lot of imported goods because the economy is pretty healthy, then it's not necessarily a negative thing. I do think, however, particularly if you look at what took place in the 2000s, where you saw this huge increase in manufactured exports to the United States from China in particular, but to a lesser extent from Mexico, I think there's no question that that had significant negative impacts on U.S. manufacturing employment. The economic literature on that is pretty definitive. And those were a lot of good jobs. You know, those were a lot of people who worked in the auto and the steel plants and others. Those were good union jobs. The loss of those were very, very costly for the individuals who lost those jobs and ended up having a lot of political impact because they were concentrated in places like Ohio and Michigan and Pennsylvania that ended up going for President Trump in the 2016 vote. So in that sense, yeah, trade deficits do matter.
So is there ever, so these tariffs are on, they're on from the U.S. side, they're on from the Canadian side, the Chinese are ramping up tariffs, the European Union has threatened tariffs. Is there ever a situation where certain tariffs are actually beneficial? And if they are beneficial, why?
Well, we're about to get a test of that. I mean, the basic theory that the world has operated under going back now about 85 years and under the leadership of the United States is that tariffs by and large are not a good thing, that we should try to bring them down. We should negotiate either globally or regionally in the case of NAFTA or bilaterally to try to lower tariffs. That allows countries to specialize in what they do best, be more efficient, and everyone becomes wealthier as a result. Tariffs can have some beneficial impacts for certain parts of the economy in the short run. I mean, it's going to help aluminum producers in the United States. It's going to help steel producers in the United States. But the evidence is pretty clear that the losers are far going to outnumber the winners. And we're going to get a real world test of all this. We're getting it right now.
Ted, what is the effect, though, you know, both in terms of direction and magnitude of new tariffs on things like the rate of inflation? You know, obviously, the U.S. and Canada, there's going to be a net job loss as a result of the tariffs. But isn't inflation and the cost of consumer goods and services also a huge issue in connection with these tariffs, despite what Wilbur Ross might say when he holds up a can of soup and says that it's only a couple cents here or there? I mean, what is the effect on the rate of inflation?
I think there is going to be a significant effect on the inflation rate, but not because of the tariffs per se. I mean, remember that the tariffs are still sort of a rounding error,
right,
in terms of the size of the U.S. economy. We're an $18 trillion economy. So, you know, tariffs on even tens of billions of dollars in imports to the United States are not going to have a significant material effect on the inflation rate. It's clearly inflated prices for some commodities like steel and aluminum, but not broadly. But if you look at this administration's policies, they are inflationary across the board. So we have a big tax cut that's going to result in a huge increase in the U.S. government budget deficit.
Yep.
That is inflationary. We have a administration that's been attempting to weaken the dollar in order to gain competitive advantage. It's not working out all that well, but their policy has been a weaker dollar. That's inflationary. So there are a lot of other things going on alongside the tariffs that are likely to fuel inflation in the economy. Now, I mean, keep in mind, the U.S. and most advanced economies haven't struggled with serious inflation since the early part of the 1980s. We've been in an incredibly low inflation environment for a long time. There are signs of a bit of a resurgence in inflation. Whether that's actually going to reach the level at which it really becomes harmful, I'm not smart enough to forecast. I think it's a greater threat now than it's been in a long time. But there are a lot of things that are continuing to keep inflation down. So I think the tariffs in the scheme of things are not the biggest thing to watch for here.
So I know that Republicans in Congress and governors, regardless of party, frankly, Republicans and Democrats in Congress for the most part, and governors across the United States, we've been courting them quite actively. Our prime minister has. We've done a full court press. And generally speaking, everybody seems pretty pro free trade, unless you're, you know, on the Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic Party, or that used to be where it was confined, the anti-trade or the anti-global trade, sentiment, so to speak. How did it become something, a rallying point for the right? I mean, not necessarily the traditional conservative right, but the populist right. Like, where did this foment come from that now this is something that is being pushed by the leader of the Republican Party, no less, the party of Reagan and Bush? I mean, it's mind-boggling.
It's really interesting, and somebody will write a great history of it someday. I mean, if you look farther back in U.S. history, I mean, we have a record of sort of lurching in and out of protectionism. We haven't seen it in many decades, but there is something of a history there. I think Donald Trump capitalized on the tremendous disruption of the 2000s. I mean, you had the financial crisis and the Great Recession, which slammed living standards for millions and millions and millions of Americans. You've had, of course, rising inequality in the United States, mm-hmm. among the worst in the developed world. You've had very weak wage growth here for a long time. I mean, you have these statistics, which I think, you know, are maybe a little shocking looking at it from north of the border. But, you know, the Federal Reserve reported recently, they've done it a couple of times over the past few years, that nearly 40% of American families say they would have trouble scraping up $400 for an emergency expense of one sort or another.
Unbelievable.
There are a lot of people struggling in this country economically. And I think Trump was able to capture a lot of that in the campaign. I think Bernie Sanders captured some of that too, which is why he did so well in the primaries. The, you know, ordinary people, for want of a better term, in the United States have been told for a long time, look, you know, globalization is inevitable. It's a good thing. Yeah, we understand that trade competition costs some jobs, but that's just the way the world is going. But, you know, if you're one of those people who lost your job, you've got no social safety net to speak of here in the United States, incredibly weak and inadequate unemployment insurance program, the least money for retraining of any OECD economy outside of Mexico, mm-hmm. your prospects are just not really good. And Donald Trump came along and said, I know who to blame, right? It's these unfair trade deals. It's these foreigners who are screwing us. That was a message that had a lot of resonance. And he really has reshaped the Republican Party from kind of a pro-business, pro-free trade party into a nationalist party, nationalist on economics, nationalist on immigration, and on a whole host of other issues. So it's a profound political realignment here in the United States. We don't know where the story ends. We're in the middle of it right now.
So, Ted, I know this is kind of asking you to get into the minds a little bit of the Trump voters, but do they realize, and I mean, I'm generalizing, I mean, there's got to be some policies, I've yet to see them really, that are helping those individuals who threw in with Donald Trump, the white working class. But you know, often I remember this book called What's the Matter with Kansas? How Kansas went kind of from the ground zero of a lot of, you know, somewhat progressive policies into kind of this hard right Republican mindset. And I guess I wonder, you know, with that as an example, do some of these folks now realize that they're voting against their interests and have their lives gotten better? If they can't come up with $400 in an emergency fund, and they've trusted Donald Trump to part the seas and make things better for them, at what point do they start to realize that they're voting against their interest when things like Medicaid and Medicare are going to be cut, when tariffs are being slapped on major allies, where there's cuts to different programs across the United States? I mean, if they have started, do they know that this guy is working against their interests and that they're in fact voting against themselves?
I think the political disillusionment in the United States right now is much, much deeper than that. I mean, from, you know, the conversations I've had with Trump voters, from a lot of the things I've read from people who've had more in-depth conversations, and vote for Donald Trump because they really thought he was going to do anything for them. They don't think anybody in Washington is going to do anything for them. They voted for Donald Trump as much as anything because he struck the right anti-elite notes.
Right.
You know, he campaigned as an outsider, and some of this is sort of weirdly local, but you know, he, you know, despite the fact that he grew up in a wealthy family, he was from Queens.
Right.
And he always saw himself as an outsider in the Manhattan financial and real estate elite. So he tapped into that. He tapped into that sort of anger that a lot of Americans have, that the political class, the people in this country who've been successful economically, aren't doing anything for them, don't intend to do anything for them, will probably never do anything for them. And so under that circumstance, if you have a choice between, you know, a sort of consummate political insider like Hillary Clinton or a candidate who at least pretends to be an outsider like Donald Trump, the outsider is likely to do pretty well. And to give Trump some credit, he showed up in these places.
Right.
Right. I mean, Clinton did not campaign extensively in Pennsylvania and Ohio. She never went to Wisconsin at all.
Or Michigan.
Trump went to these places and he talked to people there about these issues. And whether you agree or disagree with what he's doing, and I of course disagree on almost all of this, he at least went out to these places and listened to people and talked to people. So the country made a lot of mistakes. And we're paying the price for those mistakes. And unfortunately, other countries like Canada are also going to pay the price for the mistakes made here.
Well, a couple final questions, and then I'll let you be on your way. The G7 that happened up here in Canada in Charlevoix, Quebec, was, by all accounts, pretty much a disaster. The prime minister was trashed by the president almost as soon as President Trump had taken off on Air Force One. He refused to sign on to the joint communique with all the other, and President Trump, rather, refused to sign on to the joint communique with all the other world leaders on the issues that they had purportedly agreed on. How at risk is the post World War II order, you know, in things like the G7, NATO, NORAD, all of these different organizations that have been set up that has led to decades of stability? How at risk are we of the U.S. basically blowing these things up? And I say the U.S., but the U.S. administration, rather, of blowing these up. And what can that mean in the long term for us? Where do we go if we don't have the order that was established after World War II?
I mean, we will know more pretty soon. There's a NATO summit meeting later this month.
That's
coming
right.
up. I mean, you know, President Trump's views are that these institutions have worked against U.S. interests in different ways, that the U.S. has been unfairly exploited. I think that's wrong. Most people who paid attention to history think that's wrong. You know, NATO and the WTO and other international institutions have brought us a lot of stability that's allowed for you know, greater prosperity and greater security than was the case for many decades. So I am definitely worried about this. I'm particularly worried that the president doesn't seem to know how to get to yes.
Right.
I think, you know, I think the Canadians, I think the Europeans, I think the Chinese and others, I think, would like to find a way to address some of the administration's concerns over trade. I think there are countries, Canada included, that are spending more on defense and trying to address some of Trump's stated concerns about, you know, lack of of full commitment by NATO allies to their own defense. I think there are deals that can be done here, but he doesn't so far seem all that interested. He seems more interested in reinforcing his upset and anger with these institutions. I have to think in the long run that the common interests of the countries in the West are strong enough that it will survive what's going on right now. But it's certainly, there's no question, it's a disruptive and dangerous period. And I think we're in for a rough ride over the next couple of years at least.
So he's meeting with Putin next week, Vladimir Putin, privately without any aides present. I mean, I hate to get into the conspiracy theories and the Mueller investigation, but I have to ask you, what is going on there? I suppose it's everybody's best guess, but I honestly don't understand how, first of all, even from an optics perspective, even if nothing has happened, how he imagines that this looks at all good for him to be going into a private meeting with the president of Russia when he's under investigation for collusion, possibly and turning the election with Russian influence. And what is going on? Like, Vladimir Putin must be loving the disarray that is happening among traditional Western allies and fomented by the U.S. How, you know, what is happening here?
Yeah, well, I'm probably not going to be able to give you the best answer to that. You should do one of these with my colleague, Steve Sestanovich, who is our former ambassador to Russia and follows these things very closely. I mean, what I can say is it's just simply not the way these things have ever been done, right? I mean, these are meetings between heads of state, and you need an independent record of what was said in order to be able to make decisions in the future and find out, you know, are foreign leaders living up to their promises. You know, Trump seems to have a tremendous conviction about the power of his personal relationships with these various authoritarian leaders. Maybe that's his thinking in sitting down one-on-one. I just don't know. But it is, at the very least, highly, highly unusual. And there are reasons that things were not done this way in the past.
So my last question for you, Ted, is this. You spoke earlier about this being a realignment, really, from a political perspective. Do you foresee that this realignment is permanent? Is it for the next 10 years, 20 years? You know, what is the end point of this? Or as kind of a global community here, do we have to kind of start, you know, whether it's on trade, whether it's on defense, start to look for, you know, from the short, medium, and long term of building new organizations, new alliances, new trade agreements, and leaving America behind, you know? Or is this a passing storm where, you know, in 2 years or six, whenever President Trump leaves office and a new government comes in or a new administration comes in and possibly a new Congress, do things reset and go back to normal?
Yeah, I don't think anyone knows it's a very good question that no one knows the answer to. And it's one of the reasons that Canadian officials and European officials and others are struggling to come up with a sensible response because they don't have the information they need, which is the answer to that question.
Right.
I think the best strategy is the one we saw with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was when President Trump walked away from the TPP on his third day in office. The response of Canada and Japan and the other nations was to say, OK, we're going to go ahead anyway. We are going to leave the door open for the United States to rejoin if and when it changes its mind. But we are going to, you know, go ahead and ratify this new agreement and proceed. And I think you could make certainly the same argument with respect to the WTO, you know, that it's time for Europe and Japan and Canada, hopefully China and others, to step up and play a more active role in sustaining and shoring up the WTO, again, with the hope that the United States will change its position at some point. It's a little harder with NATO because, of course, the U.S. military is central to everything that goes on in NATO. But again, I think the right approach there is for other countries to be doing more to shore up these institutions, again, with the hope that the U.S. will come back to something more of a normal position in the next few years. But it's a very, very difficult calculation. And you know, you see weird things happening, like Chinese approaching the Europeans and saying, can we develop an anti-American alliance on trade?
Right.
The Europeans saying, well, no, we don't think that's a good idea. You're going to see a lot more conversations like that with everybody trying to make sense of what's going on in the United States. What's the nature of this political realignment? How permanent will it be? And what are the implications for the rest of the world? And unfortunately, much as a lot of your listeners might like to, it's hard to ignore what goes on in the United States. We're just too big and powerful and important, I'm afraid.
Indeed. It is a new world. It is a new world. Well, Ted Alden, I appreciate you very much taking the time. Thank you very much for your insight, and look forward to seeing what the next few months and years bring. That's for sure. It's going to be a ride.
Good to speak with you, Cameron. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that's the show today. On behalf of Leanne, Mike, and myself, thanks so much for tuning in. We are actually going to be moving for the rest of the summer to every 2 weeks. So the next time we are going to be on will be July the 19th. There'll be a new episode up to download and for you to listen to. My thanks to Ted Alden for his insight, for taking the time. And my thanks, as always, to all of you for making this show the success that it is. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks.